talk before. So I hope there's enough new things at least to make it somewhat interesting. Okay, first, let me just start off. There are sort of two canonical pictures of evolution, two different viewpoints. The first view of evolution is the adaptionist viewpoint. The idea is that evolution is this optimization process, climbing up this fitness landscape, trying to get better and better and better and better and better. And, you know,
the only try is to try to survive.
Right. Okay. Yeah. But the that's what I'm saying, that this is an extreme view, but this is the view of a lot of people. Who are a lot of prominence in the field, like Richard Dawkins and that school of thought. The thing is that they take survival of the fittest, you know, extremely seriously and say, if it's more fit, then it will be fitter and will survive, and anything else that is even marginally less fit will not survive. Right. Well, that goes into the other point of view, which the extreme point of view is people like Stephen Jay Gould and Kimura and Jukes and King or whatever, who see evolution as a random walk, a random biased walk, you know, so that it's not necessarily true that you wander around and that we have roughly as much fitness as the primeval ooze. But still, the idea is that a lot of the processes that are going on here represent just some type of random drift. And the amount of randomness is actually could be quite large compared with the amount of hill climbing that this is going up. So just to give a sort of an illustration of these two views, imagine that this protein or whatever has, over a length of time, or this organism, has 10 to the 20 mutations at one time or another in some member of the population. And in general, over that length of time, with all of those mutations, most of them do not survive in the population. Only about 10,000 of them are what's called fixed, become the dominant form in the population. So an adaptionist would say, 10 to the 20 mutations, those were unfavorable. So of course they got eliminated. And the 10,000 substitutions that we occur are the positive mutations. So the idea is that the positive mutations are the ones that get accepted, the negative mutations are the ones that get removed by the population. Well, the neutralists would say, you know, you have the same number of unfavorable mutations that are also accepted with say zero probability, that there are extremely few positive mutations accepted with high probability, and that most of the mutations you occur are from an even larger pool of neutral mutations, which are accepted with some small probability, generally inversely proportional to the size of the population. So the neutralists and the adaptionists would see the same evidence. Their conclusions, based upon what's going on here, would just be quite different. That the neutralists would say, okay, you have 10,000 substitutions, but 99% of these, only 100 and 10 to the 10th, are actually adaptive, that most of the observed mutations are neutral. These numbers, like 64% of all statistics, are made up. Okay.
64 made up.
Yeah. Excuse me?
What happens if you have a probability?
You do have a probability distribution, and it's interesting because the newest wrinkle in this is what's called the near-neutral theory. So the idea is that you have a distribution, but if the fitness advantage is smaller than about 1/2 the population size, it's effectively neutral. And if the difference of fitness...
And the rest have some distribution.
Oh, exactly. What I'm saying, though... Yeah. This is just to. And you're right that it is a distribution. What I'm saying is that this is a just to illustrate the difference between the adaptive school and the neutralist school. But what I'm saying is that the newest descriptions of these is what's called the near-neutral theory, where you have to include the distribution, and the fact that what you consider neutral and what you consider not neutral actually depends upon the size of the population. So things could be either neutral or not neutral depending upon the population size, even for a set fitness change. All these are made up. Okay, so it means I'm not responsible for the numbers. Okay. So when we observe something, there are sort of two initial responses that people have to things in nature. One is, if it exists, it must be an adaptation. And so the natural question when you observe some characteristic or some aspect or whatever is to say, well, how does this increase the chances of survival? You know, how is it necessary? How is it useful? How is it helpful? What is its purpose? How does having this thing increase your probability of having progeny? The other school would say that a lot of evolution is random fixation of chance events. That's a stochastic process. And that just like in thermodynamics, there's an entropic contributions to free energy. In the same way, evolution as a stochastic process involving large numbers of a population, might be not Avogadro's number, but still, you know, a decently large number, we can have the situation where the number of possibilities, basically the sequence entropy, can enter into these calculations in the same way the entropic terms enter into the free energy. And that the first thing you should do, that obviously there are some things that are adaptations. We have noses in order to be able to breathe. That's rather obvious. But that many of the things that could be potentially explained by adaptionist thought could just as easily be explained without adaptionist thought. And so one of the ideas in this school is to think, okay, let's first try to explain it based upon the generic properties of the things that are evolving. And when that breaks down, when that fails, then you could try to say, as a last resort, let's try to go into adaptionist reasoning. Because adaptionist reasoning is somewhat dangerous. One thing is that everything is a very good example of what it is. It's a perfect example of what it is. So if you look and say, how well is something at being what it is, the answer is generally really good. You know, so that's the type of circular logic that you often get into in adaptation. The other thing is it's very easy to come up with sort of what-so stories and such, and to get into what Stephen Jay Gould calls the Panglossian paradigm, where you could create, based upon the structures of what we observe, why everything makes sense in this, the best of all possible worlds. So, as I want to mention that you could probably guess that I'm very much of the neutralist approach. So when I talk about trying to explain protein properties in their evolutionary context, I'm not interested in explaining, you know, how the leopard got its spots and things like that. What I'm interested in doing is to see how this adaptionist frame of mind can try to explain a lot of the properties of proteins, even without a strictly adaptionist viewpoint and such. Okay. So, is that the next slide? Okay. So, let me just go through this very quickly. I think Zhao Tang is going to be talking about this a bit. It's observed by pretty much anyone who looks at the problem, the Cath people or the Scott people or whatever, that there's an extremely uneven distribution of protein structures. That there are some structures which are extremely common, like the TIM barrel or the four helix bundle, and there are some extremely uncommon structures. So the distribution, actual observed distribution, can be modeled as a very stretched exponential with many, many extremely few structures and a very few number of extremely common structures. So in terms of trying to understand why there is this uneven distribution of protein structures, we got interested in the question of the mapping of the sequence space to the structure space. So the idea is that you have a space of all possible genotypes corresponding to all possible sequences. you have a phenotype type space, which in this case represents all of the various possible structures. And the idea is that there's some mapping between sequence and structure, that there's some region of the sequence space that corresponds to this structure, some other region of sequence space that corresponds to this structure. And the idea is that, in general, this mapping is many to one, that there are many sequences corresponding to the same structure. It's just that some are many to one, some are manier to one. You know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, and I'm not quite sure why this is, but people have actually looked at the difference in the fitness landscape. Let's see if I can do this. I think it's go to by title. This isn't working. Okay. And it's way at the end of the slides that I've. Hey, this is interesting. It only goes up to 60. I put it at the very end of the talk. How do you like this for a long answer to a question without any words? Yeah, so the question is, the evolutionary dynamics is extremely influenced by exactly what the topology of the space is. And you're right that Peter Schuster, there's this idea of shape covering and things like that, that it seems like RNA looks something like this picture here. But it seems to be that people who have studied sort of the simple models of proteins and such seem to observe that proteins tend to be more of these compact structures over here. And I'm not quite sure exactly what the nature is of the interactions, why it is that proteins tend to be more of these compact shapes than these structures. Well, there are two different things. One is that this is largely from models. So for instance, lattice model simulations here, the Schuster type of models here. But it's also interesting that when people do experiments on RNA evolution in vitro, it seems that the characteristic patterns of the evolutionary process are different for RNA than proteins. So for instance, I could never, what is the name of that guy in, he has looked at that modeling of RNA and protein structures, trying to evolve them for new properties. And that's often correlated in RNA with a change in structure, and it's not often correlated with a change of structure for proteins. Okay. You know what it is? This 25% number that sequences that are greater than 25% are generally will have the same structure is not a statistic about similar proteins. It's a statistic about dissimilar proteins. Because what it means is you could have dissimilar proteins with up to about 25% sequence similarity by random chance. And so the thing is that if you have greater than 25%, it means you're in the subset drawn that could only be explained by generally sequence similarity in terms of evolutionary history. Well, if you're below 25%, then you could be either a member of the very distant homology sets or a member of random proteins that happen to have a certain degree of similarity. So this 25% number is the maximum amount of sequence identity that you would expect among unrelated proteins. Okay. What?
You are talking about the same thing. Can the sequences very, very different, but the same fold.
Right, absolutely. And so let me just mention,
I think it's worth finding out that the RNA could have 100% sequence similarity and get completely different structures and functions.
You're talking under different conditions like pH and things like that?
You can co-crystallize them, splicing of two completely different reactions to different data. 100%
That's great. I didn't know that. But that's one of the nice things about biology is there are always wonderful counterexamples of anything that you're trying to say. Yeah, so what you're saying is that there are regions here where this would overlap. Okay. I could imagine that if we plop these things in some random fashion, there will be some that will disperse from each other and some that are intersecting. Okay, it doesn't, but anyway, the qualitative conclusion of, the answer is that we don't know definitively, but it seems to be that for whatever reason, either the fact that the nature of the contacts is very different in terms of tertiary contacts versus base pairing, or it's the size of the alphabet, or whatever, but it does seem that most of the theoretical models seem to predict this more compact structures to this subset here than is observed in the RNA world. Okay. The other thing about the RNA is it's sort of a little bit bizarre because if I convert every A to a T, every T to an A, every G to a C, every C to a G, my sequence identity is zero, but I'll be in the same structure. And so that's a little bit of the pathology of the particular base pair mapping. But if in this model here, we generally use a 20-letter code with Miyazawa Jernigan potentials, and you don't get those type of things. Okay. Yeah. Oh, the idea, if you have A's and B's, and A's like A's, B's like B's, then you could switch A's and B's, and as long as the mixing term is zero, it doesn't really matter. Or you could set up a two-body potential that does that. But Miyazawa Jernigan, where you have...
Not appropriate question because it looks more like a cartoon rather than
metric.
But there are many proteins that have similar analogs, that have similar structure and almost no sequence similarity.
Right.
How is it reflected on this?
The problem is that this is a two-dimensional portrayal of a 150-dimensional space, right? I think that I would take away the points that I want to make, no more, no less. Yeah.
You want to make by this
point. Okay, it's just the idea that while there is a many-to-one mapping, that there are differences in terms of the degeneracy of certain structures compared with others. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Yeah.
Why do you know that? From what? I mean, is it a conjecture or is it some result
of this is this is the result of lattice simulations or whatever. Okay.
Which one?
Well, we've done simulations like this. Jao Tong.
This is what not for me.
We've done it with Miyazawa Jernigan.
Will you talk about it?
I wasn't planning to, but I could.
Okay.
What?
There are many different
Miyazawa Jernigans. But we did it with... Yeah, we got this. We got this. Yeah. Right. So what we did was we took our 3x3x3 ladder, we put in either 20-letter code, we also put in random interactions between every pair of amino acids. We looked at two-letter Nick was the one who did this work. He looked at two-letter codes, four-letter codes, different two-letter codes, and the qualitative behavior of having a broad distribution of design abilities is constant. It turns out that in our hands, the nature of the distribution depended a bit on the size of the alphabet. You know, and it depended upon, you're interested here in looking at viable sequences. So the distribution also depended upon how you define viability or non-viability. So what we used is a foldability criterion, that if it's over a certain foldability, then it would be viable, otherwise not.
Mm-hmm. I think the question is, can you pay attention only to volume or also to this shape? You have to pay attention to the volume that you pay.
Right, right. What we did, yeah. What we did was we went to a central point here. It's actually possible to find the set of interactions that that have sort of the maximum foldability for that particular structure. And then we marched off in random directions. And we tried to see how does the shape that we go to depend upon the direction that we walk off. And it tended to be something like a Gaussian fold-off in all of the different directions that we looked at. That was sort of a qualitative measure of this thing, but this is a 27 version. Yeah. The other thing is that if this, based upon the foldability model, which is based on this foldability criterion, there is an optimal foldability for a given set of interactions, which means that there's one maximum that, since we can solve for the maximum in closed form, it means that it's not a rocky, rough potential or such. So I think that it would be difficult to have disconnected regions in space, although it's Eric Bornberg-Bauer who's actually looked at the topologies of these things more than we have.
Yeah, but this would enormously depend on how you define
connectivity. Yeah, we could talk a little bit about this a little bit more. Okay, so the idea is that if you choose sequences at random, you're more likely to get, I stole this one from Darren, you're more likely to get some structures rather than others. And so the idea is that this would expect result in the idea that some structures would be more greatly represented than others. The only thing is that evolution certainly doesn't work by throwing darts at the dartboard, that that the structures arise from an evolutionary process. And the question is that we're going how to include explicitly the evolutionary process in these models to actually study the nature of the relationship between how many sequences correspond to a structure and how often that structure is observed. So what we have are two different measures. We have the designability, the number of random sequences with nadir state k over the total number of sequences. And so this is a property of the landscape. This is a property of the mapping of sequence to structure. Then we have what we actually observe. How many times do we get one structure? How many times do we observe a second structure? How many times do we observe a third structure? And this is explicitly a result of the evolutionary process. By the way, this is pretty much all I'm going to say about the designability, except to mention that a number of people have worked on this, including Eugene, including Alexei. Nick did some work in my lab on this, and Jiao Tang also, in terms of trying to understand what it is, what characteristics are important about structures as they relate to the designability of one structure or another. But what we were interested in is the relationship between designability and occupancy, that we would expect more designable structures to result in more likely structures. What's the nature of that mapping, and how that's an explicit function of the evolutionary pressure involved in this? Okay. So imagine I have some type of sequence space where I have regions in this space, and I'm walking around here. As a single walker, the amount of time I explore each structure will be proportional to the amount of sequences corresponding to that structure in the long time limit when everything's at equilibrium. So if I have one object moving along, the occupancy will be equal to the designability. What we did in these plots was we actually started off in one structure, got the occupancy of all of the structures. Then we started off in a different place, and we got identical reproducible occupancies. The what? Might be extremely low, but what we got were reproducible results. So the answer is, it depends. So we have this was based upon an idea that protein sequence had to be able to fold in order to be viable. So the big question was, what is the required foldability in order to be able to fold? And so if the foldability, required foldability is very low, then I could wander very easily through this space. If the required foldability is higher and higher, I eventually get hit a percolation threshold where things become non-ergodic and such. But the studies that we did for moderate requirements of foldability, we would get reproducible results no matter what sequence we started with, and with all of the structures being represented. Okay, but in general, individuals don't wander around, that's as bad as throwing darts, that there's a population effect in here, and that we have to think in terms of how populations evolve, not in terms of how individuals would evolve. And this is one of the insights that Eigen really was came up with, Eigen and his co-workers, the idea that it is not necessarily true, even at equilibrium, that a population will go to the highest point on the fitness landscape. So that means that even if I have a population here and a population here, it may be that this population here will not be able to compete with this population here. That what you select for is a network of sequences, and it's the fitness of the members of this neighborhood that matter, rather than the fitness of one single prototypical sequence. And the tendency to explore this range of sequence space depends upon the mutation rate and things like that. But for a decent mutation rate, you can't just look at the fitness of one individual sequence. You have to look at the fitness of the surrounding neighborhoods and such. Okay. Finite population. So the question is, how do population dynamics affect the distribution of protein structures? So what we would do is we would do population evolution on a set of sequences and count the number of times each structure results, compare that with the designability. So we were using a lattice model. You know, at least Eugene's model is three-dimensional, so we weren't even doing that. So the energy is just pairwise contact using the Miyazawa-Jernigan potentials. We were using all 1081 conformations. We pretty much had to do it in two dimensions because we were talking about populations of 1,000, 10,000 molecules. So this is about as many conformations as we could deal with. So we would start off with a given generation of members of this population. As I said, we might have about 1,000 members of this population. And then we would have random mutations where we would take certain sequences like what happened here. Here this G turned into a phenylalanine and such. So we would choose locations at random and proteins at random and mutate them. We would then calculate for this population that there are some mutations that would correspond to a new viable member, some new mutations that would be non-viable. So we would ask, are these new sequences viable members of the population or not? And we could look at, for instance, its foldability. Is the foldability larger than critical foldability? Foldability is something related to, related to what Eugene calls a z-score. It's basically how deep the native state is relative to the distribution of random states. We could calculate the delta g's because we could calculate all thermodynamics exactly. And we could ask, is this a viable protein or not? Sometimes we would look to see if the foldability is high enough. Sometimes we would see if the stability is high enough. And so we would calculate the delta g's. If delta g crit was -2, it meant that this was a non-viable sequence, this was a non-viable sequence, and we would remove them from the population. Okay, so that represents the process of mutation. The next thing we would do is try to represent the random process of replication, where we would take the first member of the next generation would be chosen at random from the set with replacement. The second member would be chosen again at random from the set with replacement, and so we would then end up with our next generation. So even a perfectly viable sequence would have a certain probability of not being selected by any of the in the next generation, just in the same way that not everyone has children and some families have more. So when we considered all sequences as foldable, and considered all sequences as viable, occupancy again is designability. You're wandering around, the fact that you're wandering around all of space as a cloud, or wandering around as an individual sequence, or choosing sequences at random, you get the same exact answer. And so we would get occupancy and designability exactly equal to each other. When we raised the stakes and said, not all sequences will fold, you have to be one of the good folders in order to fold, what we observed was something like a power law distribution of how common the sequence was compared with its designability. By the way, this scatter here is real. This scatter here is reproducible. You know, so we could even explain somewhat why points deviated from this line. So the thing that this results on is that the very low designable sequences would be even less represented in nature, while the more designable sequences would be even more represented by nature. So the process of this evolutionary process stretches out the distribution you would expect to see among proteins, where the rare ones would be even more rare and the common ones would be even more common. And you get the types of distributions that are seen in the PDB database, again, very few extremely common structures and many, many extremely rare structures. Right. And that's what the, so it's this process here that we did.
So you remove the unfit sequences.
We remove the unfit sequences. Right.
Sequences, and then as a result, you get the structures and the sequences. That it's a set of random sequences.
We start off with a set of random sequences. Yeah.
So they are distributed more or less evenly.
Actually, I think what we did was we started off with one sequence, replicated it n times, and then we would let that come to some pre-equilibration before continuing on. In other words, what we would do is we would take a single sequence, run for, 10,000 generations until everything started to be at no time dependence, and then we would take data for another 100,000 generations or so. Right, so it's constant population size. Right, so it's pulling with taking randomly with replacement. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, we still get the power law. That's what this designability is down here. This is the designability given the criterion that we're using. So here, this represents the designability of sequences with f crit equals 3.5. Is what? No. Okay, so in other words, here, what I've done is that the designability is the fraction of viable sequences folding into one structure or another. So the designability is a function of what we consider viable. So when we change the definition of what's considered viable, then the designability changes.
Sure, but is the random walk in sequence space a crucial, or can just
sort of the if you have a single molecule wandering around in sequence space, then that's the equivalent of throwing darts. When I have population behavior, population dynamics, that's when I get this power law dependence here. Make sense?
But I think what he's asking, you could also simply pick at random the sequences and throw away those which are not viable according to your criteria.
And then I would get an exact straight line, occupancy equals designability, because that's the definition of designability.
Yeah.
Okay, it's choosing things at random. Right, the definition of designability is a fraction of viable sequences. Okay, the viable is the important clue, key to that. It's right, exactly. Well, I don't know. I mean, it was the basic idea in this. Let me say that we've talked about two different types of fitnesses. One is the foldability, and the other is stability. The main thing about stability is that or one view of it is that what the protein has to do is be able to resist aggregation, proteolysis, and those type of things. So it has to be in its folded state the predominant amount of time. You know, so in this particular model, we didn't include anything else above that. In terms of the foldability, this is somewhat related to actually Eugene's lattice simulations, where this foldability measure here is very much related to Eugene's stability gap. And what he observed in his lattice simulations was that there seemed to be a characteristic range that as long as the stability gap was large enough, it would fold. If the stability gap were not large enough, it wouldn't fold. So that this was sort of motivated by those types of lattice simulations. Okay. So the idea is that if we look at where houses are scattered, where populations are scattered, the small islands are not only have less population because they're smaller, but they also have much less density of population, just because if I'm a population evolving on one of these islands, there's a much greater chance that I'll step off into the water. And so I'll have a higher death rate on this island here than if I'm on a large island where I'll be able to wander around with less chance of falling off into the water. You know, so this is the thing that gives this this nonlinear dependence of occupancy on designability. So the idea is designability considerations imply that there are some structures that are much more likely to arise than others. And that population dynamics actually makes this effect a lot stronger, suggesting that few structures would be greatly overrepresented, while many structures would be rather rare. Alexei's line, 20% of all beer drinkers drink 80% of the beer. And this has consequences for structural biology. What was that?
What has consequences for structural biologists?
Hey, I don't care what solvents they're using. Okay. So anyway, there's this idea that, and this will be sort of a topic next week, I understand, that the number of different possible structures and proteins is rather small. You know, there are estimates of about 800, 900 proteins or whatever. And that's based upon the observation that you often get the same structure over again. You know, so Greg Petsko talked about early days when you would solve a structure and ask, what does it look like? Now people ask, what does it look like? And so people have looked at the probability that a new structure has the same structure as an old structure and said, use that to justify that there had to be only a few number of structures possible. And therefore, what we should do is get one of every possible structure. Okay. This model suggests a completely different explanation for that observation. The idea is the reason we get one structure, the same structure over and over again, is not because there are a few structures, but rather because certain structures are way, way overrepresented. And that there's a long tail of this distribution where there are many, 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 many rare structures, and that crystallographers should not despair of job security or whatever, because as you keep solving more and more structures, you're pushing more and more into the tail of the distribution of novel structures. And so the very last protein family that someone crystallizes will still have a decent chance of being a structure that no one has ever seen before. You know, okay. So that's our take on that. Okay. Sequence space. So this is basically the same picture that I had before, where all of the sequences here would correspond to that structure, all the sequences there would correspond to that structure. Sequences here would correspond to non-viable sequences. They wouldn't fold, they wouldn't be viable in some way. So I have this sequence space, and as was pointed out earlier, this is actually a space, it's a sparse space in a dimension, with dimension about the number of amino acids in my protein, which is on the order of 150, 300, 500, whatever. So this is an extremely bizarre high-dimensional space. And one thing's about object, and so I have this embedded object in this extremely high-dimensional space. So one of the consequences of having this thing in a high-dimensional space is that the entire volume of this space will be on the outside of this object. You know, so the idea is that this is maybe a better characteristic, that all of my viable sequences are in the border between these colored regions and the background regions. So that's just from the high dimensionality of the space. This might give some perspective on why protein structure prediction is as difficult a job as it is. This pen is out, let me use this thing. We're never looking to identify a sequence that would be here in sequence space. We're never looking to identify a sequence that would be there in sequence space. We're always looking at sequences which are extremely marginal examples of whatever they are. Okay, so it means that we're trying to decide between whether a sequence is in this group or this group, rather than whether a sequence belongs there or belongs there. Okay, so again, just the high dimensionality of this subspace.
Richard, can you give us some insights into why at the level of lattice model this uneven distribution emerges? Because at least for me, it's important to understand the big question is whether lattice models in this aspect are transferable to protein structure.
Right.
What aspect of the lattice model gives rise to this uneven distribution?
Yeah. We've actually looked at this a bit. In general, the models that we came up with emphasize the long-range interactions. Long-range along the sequence. So basically, the idea is that. The basic idea in this model is, let me draw it the other way. That we have some type of free energy landscape or whatever. If this is going to take a while, so let me go ahead and bring the board up. Is this the board? Black one. And I have lights. So the basic idea is that we have this foldability measure, which we represent as our foldability is just delta over gamma, the depth of the native state relative to the distribution. And this comes out of some thinking about things in terms of spin glass theory, in terms of the competition between the folding rate and the glassy transition rate and such. Turns out that in the random energy model, the ratio between the folding transition temperature and the glass temperature is a monatomically increasing function of this particular parameter. So the nice thing is that if I have a lattice model here, and I have my energy function, and I ask, what is the set of interactions that maximize my foldability, I could solve for that in closed form. Okay? So it means that you give me a folded structure, a native structure, you tell me, give me an ensemble of random structures, and you ask, what is the optimal set of interactions for maximizing this quantity here? I could solve for it in closed form. It's a matrix inversion, which means that what I could do is I could calculate this in for all possible structures, and it turns out, it turns out that gamma ij goes something like minus one over the probability that contact would be formed in random structures. And then there are other terms related to correlations between these various contacts. If I have a foldability that is a function of my interactions, and I could calculate the optimal set of interactions for maximizing this quantity here, it means I could also calculate the maximum possible foldability for that particular structure. Okay, and so the idea is that there will be, if I look at my interaction space, the space of all the possible interactions between every pair of residues in the protein, for any structure, I have my optimal set of interactions, and I have my maximum possible foldability for that structure. Okay. And that a different structure would have a different optimal foldability there. So now if we imagine cutting things off, cutting things off and saying, I don't have to be here, I don't have to be here, I only have to be good enough, it means that there's a very strong correlation between how high this peak is and the volume of this interaction space corresponding to that peak. Okay? Okay. You've seen this before, haven't you? Yeah, yeah.
Then your prediction means that structures with large number of long-range contacts
would be more designable.
That's your prediction.
Okay.
Now you go to the database and check this.
Okay. Well, there are two different things. One is that you could actually, I get what it is in terms, but you could put F opt in terms of this to some power. I don't exactly remember what the power is. But it turns out that rather few long-range contacts are actually better than a large number of pretty long contacts. You know, so it's not, so things like, for instance, the contact number and things like that gets at sort of the wrong measure. Let me just mention that we have looked at this and we are working at it. The big problem, and this is the thing that's been holding this up, is that we need a distribution of random structures and that we've never been able to figure out what would be the appropriate distribution of random structures to use.
But obviously, just other structures.
That's not obvious. I mean, if you consider that if it's a if you're trying to fold from an ensemble of structures, then it would seem that you would want the ensemble of possible structures, not the ensemble of structures in the PDB.
Okay, but the point is that you are coming with some structural criterion, whatever it is, that is a predictor of the population of the family, right? And that's something that can be connected with your work. which I felt very uneasy about this model aspect of this study, that was very hard to connect with your work. But that sounds like very interesting conclusion that you can go now
Right. What we've been doing, what we have done, is we've tried to make a model of random sequences based upon, well, there are a couple of things that we could do. As I said, I'm uncomfortable using the PDB database because that's not a random ensemble from which the protein that folds. Wait. It depends. I think that the PDB is a very good ensemble of what it is, okay? But that's only what it is. And so, in other words, if you're a protein that's folding, it's not that you try the various structures in the PDB database to decide, you know, during the folding process. So what you're trying to do is, so what this is modeling is the ensemble of structures available to the protein during the folding process. And that is badly represented by the PDB database.
You seem to predict that you have structures that have a higher appearance of long range contact.
Yeah.
And those structures will be more populated.
Yeah. If you.
Did you check the database?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Now,
what
we. You say, why should I check the database? I
mean, No. There are two different questions. Wait, just a second.
Is it serious or not?
Okay.
If not, then you can try explaining why not.
Okay. Let me explain that there's two different questions. One is looking at the database to see what is the distribution of structures. The other is to use the database as a distribution of random the structures available in the folding process, and that's the thing that I did. What we did do was we noticed that there are some particular structures that according to these models were extremely highly designable. Like for instance, structures like this are extremely non-designable. And if you look in the database, they're extremely rare. Okay, you generally don't have structures like this. What tends to be much more designable are long things like this because of the long-range contacts. If you imagine that proteins have a certain size and you can't have just, you don't want a cigar-shaped protein, what you'd want to do is, at least in two dimensions, curl it up. It turns out that these structures are extremely designable in our models. And if you take off your glasses and look around the room, across the room and such, you could imagine that this is starting to be things like Greek key motifs, jelly roll folds, and things like that. So what we did was on our models, on the lattice models, we would look to see what were the highly designable structures, and we could make connections between those and commonly observed structures. Okay, so that's all phenomenological, that's all anecdotal. The right way of doing it would be to do a statistical study of the database. In order to do that, you would need an ensemble of random structures, random unstructured structures. And in order to do that type of thing, we were a little bit stymied with how to do that ensemble. So anecdotally, we could do it, okay? But on a more rigorous way, it would be a little bit more difficult. Okay? Mm-hmm. Well, the thing about the lattice is it's a little bit bizarre because it's not necessarily true on the lattice that the longest range in sequence contacts are the least likely in random conformations. There's sort of some bizarre things involved in the lattice dynamics in terms of the finiteness of the space. Okay, but it does correlate with this type of thing here. Okay. And the answer is it has to, because this is mathematical. Okay, you know that it's a mathematical derivation in closed form. Mm-hmm. Okay, any more questions about this? Okay. Oops, yeah, that's right. So the answer to basically is there is a qualitative comparison between what's observed in protein structures and the predictions of this model, but a exact quantitative model is a little bit difficult at this point. Okay. Okay. So the other aspect of this is that if this region here represents stable, foldable sequences, and this region here represents unstable, unfoldable sequences on this landscape, then these sequences right here on the margin, where all the sequences are all marginally stable and marginally foldable. So the basic idea in this is we would expect proteins to be marginally stable, marginally foldable, just from the high dimensionality of the landscape, independent of anything else going on in the model. And this just sort of says what we did was we took all sorts of sequences at random and compared their stabilities, and we calculated a histogram, and sure enough, it's this tail goes way out there. It's just that these extremely stable sequences are extremely, extremely rare.
Yeah, based on the assumption that marginally foldable sequences are acceptable.
Right.
You rule this.
We have an existence proof, though.
And you didn't say what does this wall mean?
Right.
What is the
right. But we have an existence proof, and the idea is that we have biological sequences that don't do a pretty overly good job of folding. We have biological sequences with all sorts of traps. We have biological sequences where you cool them down slightly and you start to get glassy behavior and things like that. So I think biologically we have an existence proof that says that proteins do not have to be great folders in order to be viable sequences.
No, but just peculiarly, I would say that probably you can't even get better than that. That's probably the best possible. I don't know that,
Except cytochrome C, you make some mutations and it folds a lot better. I mean, in order to make mutations in order to get a protein that folds faster or with more stability or anything like that, that's not a hard thing to do in proteins.
If you make a random mutation, typically what decreases stability?
Right.
You have
right.
To call. I mean,
you right.
Can do. You can
right.
Do, but it's not just by random chance you will roll the proper token. You have to walk.
I'm going to talk about this a lot. Okay. So the idea is that, you know, if you have evolved sequences, you have basically the same type of thing. That here we evolved on the criterion that things had to be stable, at least with a delta G less than zero. And again, things tend to be sort of pressed up against the edge of the spectrum. So it's known from biology that proteins are largely stable, about 0.2 to 0.3 EVs, okay, of stability, a few hydrogen bonds. Conventional explanation is that proteins have to be flexible in order to do whatever it is that they do, and that marginal stability represents adaptation, that they have adapted to be marginally stable in order to do whatever they have to do to function. One thing that we concluded is that marginal stability is an inherent aspect of proteins just because of the high dimensionality of the space. And that whatever function evolved in the context of proteins that were marginally stable.
I have sort of general problem with that. We sort of ran into the same kind of issues in some other contexts.
And
for this kind of selection criteria, you said that, okay, I guess it would not be marginally stable.
Right. Okay, so what I would say is, so the way I would put this is that this is, that the standard argument is to say proteins are marginally stable. Why are proteins marginally stable? That must represent an adaptation, that proteins must have evolved for the purpose of being marginally stable. So the question is, why have proteins evolved to the conditions of being marginally stable? Okay, you could always come up with some reasons. So what we're saying is that the fact that they're marginally stable does not provide any evidence whatsoever that this is an adaptation. Okay, and so that's the point that we're trying to make. So it's not that we can literally go and prove that this is not an adaptive step, but the idea is that that calling an adaptive step is something that is unwarranted based upon the data. Okay, it's unnecessary. It's an unnecessary. What about hot springs? You mean thermal? If you look at the stability in hot springs, I mean, of course, the stability has to be a little bit higher for this. But if you look at proteins, you know, that are thermostable versus proteins that are mesothermal, there's a hydrogen bond here, an extra loop a little bit shorter here. There's one great talk that I heard where they looked at 10 things that could give excess stability, and 5 of them in the thermal stable protein were giving more thermal stability, and 5 of them were giving less thermal stability than the mesophile protein. And so the idea is that it's a little bit here, a little bit less here, a little bit positive here, a little bit less here.
How is... 120 degrees centigrade.
Yeah. But, okay.
And I agree that structurally,
I don't...
But nevertheless,
I don't think 120 is a lot. You know, it was interesting. Yeah, I know. Let me just say that I think there's a lot of projection going on here, okay? So for instance, we look at these thermostable proteins and we say, gee, that would be really uncomfortable for us. How do they stand it? They must be really robust and such. And they may be, you know, lying back, sipping their mint juleps, saying, oh, this is nice and warm. Why did those other organisms wander away from these nice, warm, hospitable conditions? Yeah, so the question is, for instance, is it true that maybe, I mean, there are some theories that we evolved there, and maybe we're the radical ones. Let me just mention one thing that we observed. We were looking at substitution rates in proteins, and we were looking at substitution rates in thermophiles versus mesophiles. And what we were looking at specifically was the range of substitution rates for various types of substitutions. Okay, so we would expect that if you have purely neutral evolution, all substitutions would be about equally likely, and the dispersion in substitution rates would be rather low. If you had high selective pressure, then you would have some substitutions okay, other substitutions not okay, and so you would expect a wider dispersion in substitution rates. Make a guess, who has a larger dispersion in substitution rates? Mesophiles or thermophiles? So again, I think that this finger test of, you know, it's hot for my finger, therefore these things must be really robust and under really, really strict selection pressure, may be all wrong. It may just be that they are happy where they are. I'm just as happy as we are where we are. You know, and that, and that it may be sort of some projection going on of what would be comfortable for us projected onto what they must feel in these hot springs. Okay. I mean, for instance, if life evolved in hot springs, you know, that was the... Excuse me?
Sorry, now. Okay, that's ridiculous.
Wait. What is...
You're saying that the cupboard that has hot springs sounds like that, or else...
Well, no. Okay. Yeah. No. But the thing about it is there obvious adaptation going on? Of course. Okay, I mean, we have eyes. I mean, eyes represent an adaptation. It's not something that happened randomly here. So the argument is not, does adaptation ever happen? The question is, how important is adaptation? What percentage of the types of evolutionary processes represent adaptation? And what can be explained from the evolutionary scenario without having to resort to adaptation? You know, so what you're saying is that there is some region of space which is acceptable for thermophiles. There's some region of space which is acceptable for mesophiles, and it is true. For thermophiles, and it is true that if I'm in thermophile, I may be restricted to that space. Well, if I'm in a mesophile, I may be restricted to that space.
You've got a whole set of biochemical pathways that they
can see. Right. But I never claimed that it's by accident. No. And that's sort of the caricature. No. So the idea is that it's a biased random walk. And the question is not, is there any bias? Because of course there's bias. Of course there's that, and the bias is the amount of adaptation. And so it's a question of the relative amounts of the bias and the relative amounts of the randomness. Okay. Excuse me? Completely depends upon the rest of the people here. Half hour, yeah. Or four. Okay, 10-minute break. Okay. So basically, the idea of this was that one idea is that maybe protein functionality evolved in the context of marginal stability, and so therefore the fact that protein function might require marginal stability may be inverted. So to try this out, this model out, we imagine that there were three completely acceptable, completely viable forms of functionality. You know, one required high stability, one required moderate stability, and one required low stability. So the idea is that a green protein with a stability somewhere between these limits was just as fit, just as viable as a blue protein with lower stability here. So the idea is that there's a range of different functionalities. Mm-hmm. You have to have a big enough gap. Okay. And so the idea is that the minimal stability means minimal stability consistent with the minimal gap that you need in order to be foldable. Okay. So what we then did was we had these compete against each other, where we threw the red proteins, the blue proteins, and the green proteins together in a pool, and did this population evolution. Again, all three were considered equally viable as long as they had their characteristic stabilities. And in almost every run, 24 runs out of 25, the low stability mechanism took over. So the idea is that because proteins are marginally stable, that would favor mechanisms consistent with marginal stability. Okay? So that there would be a selective pressure on functionality to evolve in such a way compatible with marginal stability.
Do these all have the same function?
All have the same function. Right. Just because it has an advantage in terms, and it's the exact same thing in terms of the designability, that it corresponds to a larger region of designability. So rather than the idea that proteins are marginally stable because they require marginal stability to function, an alternative explanation is that proteins require marginal stability to function because they are marginally stable. Yeah. Okay. And as I said, there's no experiment we can prove to look at these two things. My reaction is it's sort of like, you know, imagine someone said to you, the reason our bodies are aqueous rather than organic is because proteins don't work in organic solvents. Okay? But that's not the way it works. Proteins work in aqueous solvents because our bodies are aqueous. You know, and so that corresponds to this other argument. Okay. Okay, yesterday. Oh, mm-hmm.
So what solvent is designing a protein that's more stable and what is the
difference? Because the. Well, there are two things. One is that has somewhat been done. Francis Arnold sort of looked at protein substitutions or whatever and looked at functionality versus. Stability and got no correlation whatsoever. You know, points look like a dust cloud. But in general, though, if I have this model here,
which means that this number one seems to be incorrect. The yellow.
Right.
At least for the protein and for the experiment.
What she did, yeah. And so the result is that this is still controversial and that there's not a definite definite point there.
Are you aware about any experiment? You definitely looked into this literature. Are you aware of any experiment when there was anti-correlation between functionality and stability?
Anti-correlation.
Yeah, of course, because I mean that's the ground of this statement that they need marginal stability to function.
Well, you could. As I said, with Frances Arnold's work, she got a scatter. So you just look at the low points of that scatter, and those would correspond to enzyme catalysis or whatever this protein was doing better when being more stable. But again,
worse. No correlation means no correlation.
Right. But the thing about this is that if this is true, that there are these three separate mechanisms, what happens here is you end up with the blue proteins. So if you take the blue proteins here that you've ended up with,
you can go in an experiment and make a protein that's more
stable. Right. But it turns out that so let's imagine that it's this case over here where you have blues, reds, and greens. Okay, and so here it's not that there are some proteins that work best under moderate stability, some proteins work best under high stability, some proteins work best under minimal stability. If you take a blue protein and make it excessively stable, it won't work as well. Okay? If you take a red protein that is too unstable and you make it more stable, it will work better. So the question is, so the experimental observation in terms of will extra stability help or hinder is based upon, are you looking at a blue protein, a red protein, or a green protein? And the answer is you're almost always looking at a blue protein. So in other words, nature selects for those sequences which are optimized or do well. Excuse me?
That's for a three protein to do the same job.
Right. Right.
You have a green one.
But there aren't any green ones left. There aren't green ones left. That in general, whenever there's a number of different options that are available, the ones that you're going to get are the bluest ones. Because those are the ones that are the most designable, correspond to the largest number of sequences. Does that make sense? So that's why I say it's as blue as possible. Okay. Yeah, so there are proteins that are rocks, you know, BPTI and things and alpha alkaline phosphatase and things like that. You know, and so my guess is that those are things that you need. For instance, BPTI is in a very hostile environment and such. So my guess is that that's, as, again, as blue as it is on the spectrum. It's just that, and Seb's not here, but it's the same thing with thermophiles. That may be that green, that red is as blue as you could get. Okay. Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. Okay. Yesterday, Ego said to me, yesterday we learned that to rough approximation, patterns of hydrophobicity are sufficient for protein structure formation, yet last week we learned that even hydrophobicity can be changed. Okay? So the thing that seems to come out of looking at proteins is extreme amount of plasticity. That you change this thing and it doesn't matter. You change this thing, it doesn't matter. You change this thing, it doesn't matter. You change, what was the talk yesterday? 23 out of 50 substitutions with alanines and things don't matter, okay? So, you know, what's going on here? It's sort of like a football player, you know, who loves playing injured. You know, he gets hurt and he says, oh, I'm fine, coach, put me in. You know, so what's going on here? Why is it that sequences are as robust to substitutions that occur? So what we did was we looked at sequences and we looked at what fraction of substitutions are destabilizing. So we would take a sequence at random, and we could compute delta G for that protein.
For which one?
This is for the 5x5 lattice protein again. And we would take one of the amino acids and change it to another amino acid, and we would ask, is the resulting protein more stable or less stable? Okay, and it turns out that as long as the protein is reasonably stable or even somewhat stable or even not very stable but not on the extreme, almost any change that you make is going to be destabilizing. Okay, and that makes sense. Just and this was pointed out by Fisher in 1920 something or whatever. If I'm over here and I make some substitution that puts me in some other direction, because of the curvature of the space and the high dimensionality of the space, I'm going to be going in this out direction more likely than I'm going to be going in the old, in the in direction. So in a high dimensional space, we'd expect as we move from here to someplace else, things are going to be destabilizing, and that's what we observe. Or another way of looking at it is if I have a sequence that's stable or whatever, if I make a change, it's going to be in the direction of putting it towards a random sequence. So I'm going to get something more likely in this range here, and this is what I have, what I get. So for instance, if I would look at sequences with delta G less than zero, and I look at the magnitude of delta G, I find that it jumps up pretty much where you would expect given the distribution of where random sequences are. Okay, and the same thing here, that these sort of things march across. So what happens as I make a change in my protein, and it's a small protein, I think 25 residues long, I'm getting more less a random final value of the energy. Which
what is KTC?
Oh, all of these energies. All of these energies are in kcals per mole.
This is a model protein. This says nothing.
Uh-huh.
What is KTC?
KTC.
Critical temperature multiplied by Boltzmann constant. What is in your model?
I think it's 0.6.
As large.
About 0.6, yeah.
The green is much sharper.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, so this is the distribution of delta G for random sequences. One thing that we noticed was we did our population evolution runs, and we took members of our evolved populations, and we did the exact same study, and we ended up with an extremely different curve. Okay, so let's imagine we have two proteins. one protein is pulled out of our evolution runs with population evolution. One protein is chosen at random. They have the same structure, they have the same stability. Okay, I take these two proteins, I mutate one, it's almost certain going to be a destabilizing mutation. I take this other protein from my population simulations and I make the same random mutation on it, and I have a very good chance of being stabilizing. Okay, so that somehow this protein knows whether, as I said, same stability, same wild type stability, same structure, it has embedded in its sequence its history of being either from a population evolution or from a random selection. So for instance, this is the same curve that I did before. These shows the distributions in delta delta G for mutations for random sequences. And we could see how the distribution of delta delta G's for evolved sequences as, that are driven out of our population evolution is very much centered right around zero. Okay? That's not it, because look what, let's see. Because look at it this way. I'm taking a sequence here and a sequence here that have the exact same stability. Okay? So I'm saying that here I have a sequence that is as marginally stable as this one is, but still, if I make mutation, this will be definitely a destabilizing mutation. Well, if I make mutation here on this one, it will be about 50% chance of being stabilizing, 50% chance of being destabilizing. Do I have a picture of what? Isn't it bizarre? When we got this result, the graduate student who was working on this project, Darren, I said, this makes zero sense. Go back. You have a bug in your program. Work at it a little bit more. So I kept working at it until, and it turns out that he was right, and I was like, oh, by the way, look at this one. This is delta G critical. So this represents in our population run what we consider viable and what we consider non-viable. And you see that for random sequences, again, if we look at all the sequences with over a given amount of stability, again, we make a substitution, and it's almost certainly going to be destabilizing. Well, if you look at single mutations in population-derived proteins, they have a good chance of being stabilizing. Triple mutations, I have a sequence of length 25, I make three mutations in it, and I still have a decent chance that that new sequence will be more stable than my wild type. Okay. So what's going on here? Remember that what I talked about with Eigen before, that you're not selecting for a single sequence, you're selecting for a population of sequences. And so it's not that evolution selects the best example of a sequence, the most fit example of a sequence. Instead, it selects a population, a network of sequences. So that I could imagine this region here corresponding to viable sequences, these regions here corresponding to nine viable sequences. And if I choose a sequence at random, I'll get one of these sequences here, which have a very high probability of mutating to something worse, non-viable, or whatever. When I do population on this, what I get is a sub-network that gets pulled out from my evolutionary model. So what I do is I select for not one example of here, but I select for an interconnected set, which has a minimum of connections to unstable proteins and a minimal connection to other members not in this network. No. So what happens is, if you look at Eigen's equations, what you do is you have you get an eigenvector of populations at steady state corresponding to the dominant eigenvalue, which has a certain population at a number of different sequences. And so the steady state population involves a steady state amount of each of these members here, that there's some steady state polymorphism. And that the amount of that you would get, or even the probability of ending up with these with a finite population, would correspond to not only how stable this is, but how stable are its neighbors. No, I don't think so. What I'm saying is that you're selecting not for sequences, you're selecting for networks. And what you're doing is, since the networks are dependent upon, that you're selecting for, are not only dependent upon, you know, the master sequence or whatever, but also sensitive to the fitness of the things around it, you select for those members that are not only have high fitness, but that are connected to things of reasonably high fitness. And it's interesting that this the population evolution found it on its own. You know, so it was able to find those sequences that I could do up to 3 mutations and still have a reasonable chance, or still have some chance of being actually more stable that way. So what we would do here is we would just take a sequence. Okay, we just calculate its delta G. Then we would calculate mutations to it at random and see what fraction of them are stabilizing or destabilizing. Okay, which is why we don't have any data left at this point, because you never get a random sequence more stable than that. Okay. Okay, and then these are the evolved population of the evolution runs, where we take one of these members of the populations and do the same thing. Okay, so this means, so the consequence... Okay, so the idea is that I have a whole set of viable sequences and a whole set of non-viable sequences. If I choose a sequence at random, I could choose any one of these green sequences. I choose one at random, and I see when I make a mutation, I'm very likely to evolve to something worse. Okay? On the other hand, when I do the population evolution work, what I do is I select for a network where not only the sequence that emerges is fit, but it's surrounded by fit neighbors. Absolutely, absolutely. Right. So is there a way of doing a clean separation between red and green? No. So what you would have then is you would have a more likely representation of something with the minimum connections to non-viable and the minimum amount of connections through other sequences to non-viable. So that would be what you would be selecting for. So you would be selecting, there's no way of confining yourself only to the red distribution, then we would all be immortal, but rather that you select for the sequences that can find, isolate yourself away from harmful substitutions as much as you can. What do you mean, entropic exclusion?
If you have a one-dimensional, say, potential,
I think that is essentially that. The only thing about it is that that you have examples here which are right at the border here, okay? So that you have sequences which are right. And actually there was a slide in the marginal stability. You can see that a little bit here, you know, that there is a sort of depletion here. But still, if I choose a sequence here or a sequence there, I get very different behavior. Right. No. This sequence here is right at the outside. Okay. So what I'm saying is, so I think that I don't know how to draw the correct picture. What I would want to do is I would want to do this picture here, but only pop, but have everything here squeezed to the outside. Okay? So the idea is that I have things that are squeezed to the outside, but I have things to the squeezed to the outside that represent things with lots of connections to non-viable neighbors, and I have things squeezed to the outside that are connected mostly among themselves. And what I select for are the things that are squeezed around the outside that are mostly connected to each other, to other viable members. Okay, does that make sense? You're right. And if you come up with a better way of visualizing it, I'll try to make a transparency of it. So it means that there is a perceived robustness to substitutions. So that if we take a biological protein, okay, and we do the types of experiments that were talked about yesterday, we will get the sense of sequence plasticity because of the evolutionary heritage, and that plasticity may be because of the fact that nature is selecting for a specific subset of sequences rather than random sequences. Okay, so this suggests that if we were to take a design sequence, if we were to get a design sequence, that the robustness of the design sequence towards substitutions would be quite different from the robustness of evolutionarily derived proteins. Right. So what I did was I said, okay, this point over here is connected to three reds, so therefore this is more a red than a yellow. Okay, if you wanted to make it maybe a little bit more orange, that would be fine. Right. So what I'm saying is that you would select for those subset which reduces your contact to the outside. There's no way of finding a set here that has no connections to the outside at all. Okay. So what you do is you select for those set of sequences that have the minimum connection to non-viable sequences. What you do is you select for the network that has the least contact with the outside. Okay. So the idea is that that all of these experimental results, I mean, one of the main things that happens in terms of getting insight into proteins is to take an amino acid out, shove another one in here. And this suggests that the results of those experiments may be somewhat misleading and give a sense of robustness to substitution that may be not true of proteins in general, that you would not expect of a random sequence with the same properties. It also means that we have this idea that the fitness landscape is like this, that things are very plastic, that you could change a lot of things and you're still doing okay because of all of this history of these side substitution works. But in reality, it may be that we think we're on a broad, flat maximum just because we're confined into that network of viable sequences, and the real fitness landscape could be much more narrow and have much more steep walls than we would expect based upon these side substitution works. Which means that if you're dealing with protein engineering, we think we're going up here. We think that things are robust. We think that things are plastic. We think that if you get close enough, it will be somewhat good. Get better and better and better, it will be better and better and better. And pretty soon you'll find yourself up here somewhere. If this is true, that could be an artifact of the way of the experiments that are done. And it could be that you could wander around and have to get very close before you're actually able to engineer a protein that will work. Okay. So
I understand. I understand that all these proteins work if they peak, but only the only difference is history.
Right.
How it has evolved.
Right.
So
right.
In protein engineering, you just make a sequence without history, without
right. Right.
This additional acquire.
Right. Right. And so what you would do is it would not have the same robustness as.
If you put it into bacteria.
No. It would, just in general, it would not have the same robustness to whatever functional selective pressure that you put it under. It would not be as robust.
So, you say selective pressure. That means that if you put into something which really regenerate successor.
Or what you do is you do it whichever, or you do it artificially. You make a substitution and you ask, is this is it a stable?
Okay.
Okay.
Is this safe?
Right. But look at it the other way around, okay? So what we say is, we think we're up here, and we think based upon our site substitution work that we're off by one or two or three amino acids. We think, well, we'll still be up high, okay? Which means that if we get three away, will have solved the problem, because three away is probably pretty much the same as being right on. Okay. Conversely, if we look at the random ensemble of sequences, which are, you know, which we're more likely to find, if we have a random ensemble, it's not going to have the same robustness to substitutions that an evolved protein is going to have. Which means if you're one off, that could be dead. It could be lethal, it could have no activity, it could be garbage. Okay? Which means if you're approaching it from the other point of view, it means that if you're almost there, you have one substitution away from something that would be perfect, and you won't know it because it's garbage. Okay, so there's this idea that the design process may be a lot harder than we expect, because our belief that the design process should be easy is based upon the plasticity of sequences, which is an artifact of biological proteins that wouldn't be true of design proteins. Make sense? With sort of a non-committal nod. Okay. So the idea is proteins are marginally foldable, marginally stable. No evidence that marginal stability represents adaptation. As I said, it's not that I can definitively prove that it's not. There's just no evidence for it. Maybe proteins require marginally stability to function because proteins are marginally stable. And that evolutionary stability is more important, that there's a selection for these stable networks, and that one of the reasons why we observe sequence plasticity is because there is selection for sequence plasticity. Okay. So let me just talk about the designability work was really started by Sridhar. Nick has also been doing a lot of work, which I understand he'll talk about sometime about his designability. But the population work was really done primarily by Darren Taverna, and is being continued on by Paul Williams. Okay. And any last questions? Okay. Okay, that's it.